Yeah, when I got the ulcer, one of the key a few things the key things that really helped me were related to breath work. I mean, diet was awesome, but breath work was even more. And I basically signed up for an art of breathing course that was from the Art of Living Foundation, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. And so they have this course, they run it all around the world. I heard also in Silicon Valley, like there is like a bunch of entrepreneurs who have met like each other, you know, to do this particular breath work. And basically I learned the basic pranayama breathing techniques. In Art of Living, they have this Sudarshan Kriya breathing practice, and it was like the best return on investment.
Welcome to Take a Deep Breath. Today's breathwork guest is Timo Arena, and Timo is a biohacker, an author, and a human optimization performance specialist. I had to just remember the last little bit there. Timo is a really interesting character because he has spent a lot of time, and I assume money, researching the top ways to live a healthy, optimal, biohacked life. And one of the reasons that I love having these all-round biohackers on the Breathcast is because I think every single time that I've spoken to one of these people, and again, they've invested in technology, gadgets, often some of the most powerful things that have helped them on their own journeys is breathwork. And it's free, and it's here, and it's accessible to all of us. And so it's just this lovely reminder, isn't it, that you know, you don't need to be rich, you don't need to have loads of money in the bank to practice breathwork. And the people that, you know, have access to all these things tend to also practice this wonderful free thing that we have, this gift of conscious breathing. So I really enjoyed talking to Timo. He's got a really interesting outlook on life, and we actually talked a lot about death as well. Not too morbid, I don't think, but really interesting. You know, from a point of view of somebody that's a classed as one of the world's top biohackers, author of the Biohackers Handbook, what's his thoughts on death? Is he one of these people that's trying to outlive it? Is he trying to live forever? And actually a very grounded approach to life and death. So I think you're going to get a lot from this. He talks about how he healed himself with his stomach ulcer, and one of the most powerful things there again was breath work. So yeah, really, really interesting episode and really interesting guy. His details are down below, so please go out and check out his website. I'm just gonna give you a couple of quick messages before we get stuck into the Breathcast then. We're on Instagram on Take a Deep Breath, so it's takeadeepbreath.co.uk. So if you haven't followed us yet, please go over there and do so. And I've mentioned this a couple of times now. In the background, right now, where are we? 23rd of May. This will probably go out in a week or so, a couple of weeks. I'm working on a breathwork course. I'm taking the last 4 years' worth of knowledge, experience, speaking to the world's top breathing experts, my own daily practices, and putting all that together into some affordable, accessible program. So, yeah, that's still early stages, but I wanted to get it out there because it's been in my head now for probably more than 6 months, if I'm really honest, 9 months. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do that soon. So I feel like making that kind of verbal commitment to you guys, to letting you know that that's on its way. And I'll make sure that obviously there's a good price, and you guys get a discount because you're watching it through Take a Deep Breath. So yeah, that's on its way. Very exciting. First time I've ever done anything like this. So I'm mad in the background, scribbling stuff down and getting ready to film that. Anyway, I hope you really enjoy Timo. I really did. He's very chilled. And the last thing I'll say, he's the same age as me and he looks about 15 years younger. So he's doing something right. It was very upsetting to know that he's actually, I think, a year older than me. Damn you, Timo. Okay, right. Here we go. On with the Breathcast. Thanks, everybody. We are recording. So, Timo, thank you so much for giving us some time. It's a real pleasure to get to talk to you today. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good.
Good.
I mean, the spring is coming. The sun has been shining here in
Yeah.
Estonia, where I live now. And yeah, it's I'm not worried at all about the pandemic. I think this is one of the best times to be alive,
Yeah.
actually.
Fantastic. Yeah. Oh, that's great, because it would be good to talk about COVID at some point with you as well. So I think we're going to have a lot to cover. We've got to try and squeeze it into the next 60 minutes. If you wouldn't mind, just for our viewers, would you mind just sharing with me a little bit about your backstory? How did you get to being the person you are today?
Yeah, I mean, I started as an entrepreneur when I was 16. I'm 39 now, turning 40. And I kind of got early into being what other people described as a child prodigy. So I was into educational technology and looking at how education is changing through online learning. And I did also end up as a kind of a futurist on that area, going around the world talking about where we're going in terms of man-machine interactions and how technology influences learning and performance and work in the future. And that got me slowly into social technology, social media, and how that influences learning, and then later companies. And I was very early on actually introducing social media in my country. That was after 2000s. I started my blog that was in 2003. So that was very early. I remember giving presentations about social technologies and asking people, how many of you know what a blog is? And I would see a single hand maybe in an audience of a few hundred people. So that got me into speaking. So I started talking about how technologies are changing the way how we work and learn. And eventually I ended up as a management consultant in helping them to transition to new ways of working online, so bring collaboration technologies within the organization. And that kind of really kicked off my speaking career. And I ended up all around the world speaking and talking about how new technologies are changing our lives. And I was always interested in startups as well, and maybe running my own startup. And I was advisor already for a few of them. So I decided to found one, and I found one company that was focused on changing the way how we meet and collaborate online. And I raised 1.5 million euros for that one. And yeah, I thought I was living my life, you know, to the fullest. It's my dream, you know. I was close to 30. And but I have to say, entrepreneurial life is hard. And when you turn 30 years old, like, I mean, your body is it's not gonna sustain everything under the sun. So I got some stress related issues. I didn't sleep enough. I was like constantly sending emails and working, didn't have a lot of breaks. And simultaneously with my startup business, I was also continuing speaking career, going to conferences, flying a lot around the world, and all that. So I ended up having an ulcer. So some gut issues, an inflammatory disease, and I got some medication for it. And the medication, it took the pain away, but it really, I mean, my energy levels dropped. I was tired all day long. I didn't feel like having the energy that I used to have. And after 9 months of suffering on that condition, and also being prescribed more and more medication, I started studying the medication that I was taking, and I realized this is not something you're supposed to be taking when you're 30 on a continuous basis. So I started looking into stress-related illnesses, inflammation, and gut issues, and all that. And I ended up designing, I ended up designing a protocol to heal myself. And what led me to that is that I'm a very analytical person. I'm interested in the way how systems work. I've been a CTO, so I've been running technology stuff. I understand technology. I also, as a management consultant, I started looking at organizations as systems and got into systems thinking, the same in the area of learning. So I started looking at the human body as a system. So I took the systems approach and started looking at what's wrong with this system. start mapping it out. And I don't believe in gurus or experts or whatever pros you find online or wherever, like, who say you do this, you're gonna be healthy. I want to dissect things and understand things myself. So I went to medical literature databases like PubMed. I started studying ulcers. I started studying stress-related illness, low-level inflammation. And so I started designing a dietary protocol. The dietary protocol was basically in its backbone an anti-inflammatory diet designed to attack this very specific problem. So it was an elimination diet. So I took out food items that would increase inflammation. I put in food items that would reduce inflammation or support the body in healing. And I went very deep. It was not just diet. It was also sleep optimization. I started looking at meditation, breathing techniques, a bunch of other things. And while working on that one a few months, got really deep into the rabbit hole, I realized that this is a black box. The human body is a black box, and I have to make it visible somehow. So I started looking into ways of quantifying self-quantification, basically to understand what's going on in the body. If I do any intervention, if I change my diet, if I, you know, meditate more, if I sleep more, what's going to happen? So I started looking into different ways of tracking and gathering that information myself. And at that time, wearables were not really that readily available. They were not in a supermarket, you know. So I ordered some of the up and coming devices and technologies and got into this so-called quantified self movement. And that revealed the whole thing to me. Like, I mean, it became obvious to me that the human body is a biological computer and it can be influenced by changing the inputs. You can change the output. So I started slowly making black box visible. I did lab tests also. Like, at that time, doctors wouldn't send me to lab to get the labs that I wanted. So I actually traveled. I lived in Finland at that time. I traveled to Estonia and went to a lab. I gave them money. I said, I want this test to be done. And they were like, okay, this is not, you know, typical. Someone comes straight to the lab. But yeah, I did. So that was basically 10 years ago. I get a lot of tests done, and I revealed things that needs to be addressed related to blood sugar management, related to lipids, related to certain nutrients, related to inflammation, like high-sensitive C-reactive protein, and a bunch of other things. And it all motivated me. Also, when I started tracking my sleep, I realized it's a game, you know. You get information every morning, and that in itself influences your willingness to pay attention to sleep. So to me, all this quantified self technology was actually a kind of a way of paying attention to my behavior, and it made me very aware of it. So actually it motivated me to keep on going and changing these things. So when I started doing my protocol, after 3 months, I was symptom free of, I cut the medication also. I was symptom free, and it was designed to be temporary, kind of a desperate act. And I continued, and I noticed my allergies going away. I used to have seasonal allergies, so those disappeared. And so I got like energy levels that I didn't have before I got the ulcer. So I felt more energetic. I didn't have any dips of energy throughout the day. I was just like going. So what was designed to be temporary became a permanent lifestyle change. And then I started talking about this to other people, and I invited a group of people together in Helsinki to share what I was up to. And one of them was Dr. Olli Sovijärvi, who is now the co-founder of the Biker's Handbook with me. There was people who went on to found the Oura Ring company also. There was people who have been behind a lot of different biohacking startups and companies in Finland. Many of them well known nowadays, but at that time, all of us were pretty much early on into it. And that was like 2012 or something like this. It actually grew. So we started having these meetups, and suddenly we had hundreds of people, and then even more. And it really grew, like from those meetups to this international movement. So we pretty much, like, together with my colleagues, Dr. Olli Sovijärvi and Jaakko Halmetto, who's a nutrition specialist, and our work on the, this is the Biohacker's Handbook. So our work on this book got very well known in first in Finland and then internationally. In Finland, we were in radio, television, newspapers like almost every week in 2014 and 15. The book came out in Finnish language in 2016, but we gave like 100 interviews every year, and it actually became synonymous to the change in healthcare, to preventive healthcare, to prevent disease, optimizing health. So biohacking never really was like some weird stuff in my country. They actually like it. It's been on political agenda and so on. Like, this is the preventive health. Like, this is, and they actually relate that to the quantified self aspect, digital health aspect, like how the patient can measure themselves and use that to change their lifestyle and maybe work in collaboration with experts. So that was kind of the angle we emphasized, made it interesting and less woo-woo, and basically always based everything that we wrote on scientific evidence, meta-analysis, and so on. So over the years, like, biohacking was taken seriously, not as some kind of alternative health thing, really, but kind of serious, vigorous scientific backed effort to optimize health, and we kept that way. And yeah, so I was healed of my problems. This book, which was basically, we started writing this out of just love to these things. Like, we were not really looking to influence anyone. We just want to put these things on paper and do the research properly for ourselves as well. Mm-hmm. And we were all interested in that with Jaakko and Olli. And in 2015, we founded the Biohacker Center in Finland, and we started organizing the Biohacker Summit. We have now had 10 events organized, and we published the book, and we also continued into first making also online courses in Finnish, now also internationally, and we opened up our own online store for people who are interested in all these devices. And today we are one of the biggest biking related companies in Europe, and one of the biggest events in the world in its area. And we still continue doing these things because we love and are personally enthusiastic and enchanted, I would say, of what optimal health and performance can bring.
Oh, that's incredible. What a story. And I've heard that a few times with different people, actually. You know, it's that thing around you get sick and then you try to heal yourself. And by healing yourself, it opens you up into a different path. So it's really interesting to hear that. What's also a little bit upsetting for me is you're 1 year older than me, and I think you could be 15 years younger than me, maybe even 20 years younger than me, looking at you on the camera. So
it's ridiculous. Like, I mean, I look at photos of myself like 10 years ago, and I see an older guy than I see it. So I was definitely beating myself to the ground with the work that I was doing. Like, I thought that, you know, world was outside of me, that, you know, I was interested in all the intellectual stuff and how to do things and all that, and I ignored my body. And I would say I aged faster during that time. And now I've been able to slow it down. And I've done some epigenetic tests and genetic tests and lab work and so on. And I see across the board indication that I'm probably like more likely to slow down aging than accelerate it. And that's good. I wish I had known these things when I was like 20, but I think people need to learn these things the hard way sometimes. And that when you referred that people sometimes, like in this community, they had health issues, they healed themselves, they become enthusiastic about it. That's the Greek mythology, basically, of the wounded healer. Wounded healer is the concept of what was promoted, especially by Carl Jung and other philosophers and psychiatrists and psychologists, as the means through which many therapists come to be. Like many of them are actually solving their own problem.
Nice.
So if you look at people who work in psychology, for example, many of them have childhood trauma. So they are fixing their own problem. Now, if you look at the biohacking community, like you're kind of weird if you don't have a story of how you were inflamed and almost dead, and then you turned around the stakes and suddenly you're healthy. And you're a role model in that sense. Like in the biohacker community, if you take like Dave Asprey, for example, would Dave Asprey be him without his story of like almost destroying himself? Like that's the thing. Like I have met very, very few people who don't have that backstory and or before and after images or whatever. And that's the thing. It strikes your core of being when you get sick, and if you somehow survive from it, you avoid getting into that place again. But often people become a little bit too, dogmatic.
Mm.
They become almost religious about what works and what doesn't. And I think that's something you have to be careful of, that you don't start to believe your own story in a way. That's the dark side of the wounded healer is that they might start thinking that they are onto something. They have revealed the keys to the universe. They know something that no one else knows. And that inflates their egos. Like they start to believe too much about themselves. It's the same with doctors. I mean, if they take too much responsibility, or any therapist, if they take too much responsibility of their patient, they actually might get the illness that their patient has. This is like statistically true. Like people who treat specific diseases, they're more likely to get it themselves.
Oh wow.
That's like ridiculous. But and that's why in many healing arts you kind of clean yourself after working with someone. You don't carry their problems with you.
Yes.
So that's one angle to it. It's more metaphysical, but just from a physical sense or scientific point of view, I think it is it's good if you have personal experience.
Mm.
So my colleague Dr. Olli Sovijärvi always says, like, how can he heal someone if he doesn't heal himself first? Like, would you ever take advice from someone who about health or nutrition or whatever, who looks like super sick and tired and stressed and
yes.
On the brink of collapse? Like, and that's the story for a lot of doctors, unfortunately. Like but there's great individuals out there also, like, who are, you kind of put if you're in an airplane and there's some turbulence, you first put the oxygen on yourself before you put it on someone else. That's kind of the concept here. Like, take care of yourself first, then you're able to care other people. But don't start to believe too much about yourself, because in the end, people do it to themselves. You can inspire them, but they do the change. It's not you doing anything right there. So, yeah, I mean, I've gone through, the deep, very deep into this and have my own personal physical emotional trauma related to healing, and Now I'm here, just like I love this stuff. I want to disseminate the information, what seems to work, but in the end, it's your work to figure out what works for you.
No, I love that. And you seem like a very grounded person, and I like the fact that you are into the science and the statistics that sit behind it, because sometimes with this stuff, it can get potentially a little bit woo-woo, but I like it when we talk about numbers. I'm keen to get stuck into breathwork, but before I do, I've been listening to what you're saying. I want to ask you a question about death. How do you perceive your own death? This might be a bit deep. And do you see it as, well, do you know what? I'll probably still get to the average life expectancy of, what, 79 to 81, but I'll be more functional to the end. Or do you see it more as, no, I'm going to, my plan is to far out exceed the average life expectancy and be functional deeper into whatever, old age?
That's a very good question. Because in the end, like, there is people out there in the biking community, because it's vast. I mean, there is the whole anti-aging, longevity, community, and I've noticed that a lot of people are actually like afraid of death. Like they want to be immortal, because it's kind of a creation story. If you look at people in Silicon Valley, for example, who are into optimizing their health and who want to live forever, and they have all the money to do it. The Google brothers or Peter Thiel, there's all these people who have a lot of wealth and who are into biohacking and are into optimizing themselves. Sometimes I think about, like, are those people actually just afraid of death? Mm-hmm. And that's one key question right here, because what connects all of us is that we will die one day. And all religions have, some kind of story of how we're going to escape, the fact that we're going to die. And if you don't believe in secular religions, let's say you're an atheist, you still come up with some kind of story. For example, energy changes its form, Mm-hmm. You always have a story of immortality. I will die, but my molecules will continue, existing. Mm-hmm. So the one way how I think about this is that if we increase lifespan, let's say we have increased in the modern age, in the industrial era, we have doubled our life expectancy, let's say from 40 years to 80 years old. Mm-hmm. At the same time, our world, our work, and the way how we do things have changed exponentially. Look at it, like the technological acceleration of change, it has completely changed our lives. The pandemic today, this is super chill. We have internet, you can socialize with people. Imagine being in quarantine, in Spanish flu times or something like that.
Yeah.
The food would run out because they were not, the farms, the international logistics was not run by robots as it is today. Like, there's very few farms that are actually manned, like, with humans. So we don't have food shortages. Our logistics works still. The logistic companies have actually increased in value in these times. So we are in a very good place, and logistically, like, our ability to move bits around is another story. Like, we are using Zoom now to make this call. Zoom is 7 times bigger than the 7 largest. It's bigger than the 7 largest airlines combined. Wow. Thanks to the pandemic. And it's a new way for people to get things done in a way. So to me, yeah, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times, but in the end, our technology is what gives us the leverage. Now think about if we were able to double our lifespan from here, or let's say increase 20-30%, all of us are going to live on average to 120 years old, for example. How would the world look like, How would your career look like? What kind of decisions would you make with family? In agricultural society, you would get married as quickly as possible because you died early. And when you get sick and if you age, you need, some help, and you need help on the field. So you want to reproduce. So marital things were like our agreement. It was not, to express yourself or something like this. It was often agreed beforehand by wealthy families. Now, what would you choose if you were able to live 120 years old? And or immortal, like what if we all were stuck to being 21 on a continuous basis? Like what kind of decisions would you make? I mean, this would change society. And in the end, I see it as a completely unsustainable idea because the world around us is changing faster than we are now because we age, we live longer, but the world is changing faster. Our genetics is not keeping up. In 2017, the average life expectancy in US started declining. They are no longer living older. They have all these degenerative diseases, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. What is it related to? Our lifestyle. What is our lifestyle related to? The fact that our, you know, way of being changed. You know, we sit in front of computers, we sit in cars, elevators, whatever. We don't move our bodies. We eat, you know, crappy food. And there is all these like, whatever, antibiotic resistant bacteria in our food chain and all these Franken things that we created. Now, there is no other choice for us to live forever is other than starting to change ourselves to adapt to the environment, the new environment we are in. So basically, to live forever, I see no other option but genetic modification of the human organism somehow. Okay. Because that happened through natural selection, that happened through evolution. Now we are moving from evolution by natural selection to evolution by intelligent design. So we have all kinds of protocols and ways of influencing epigenetic change. Biohacking, in a way, is a soft way of doing it. Like you are doing things like cold therapy or sauna or breathing to activate genes related to longevity, for example, or you get yourself into a state of autophagy so that your body is recycling damaged cells and you are basically programming the system in an indirect way. You might do genetic testing and lab testing and you optimize the values and all that. So we kind of become aware that to be able to survive, we have to become very in tune with how our biology is related to its environment. And if the environment is not supporting it, whatever, you know, stressors you see in there, it could be, you know, light pollution, like blue light blockers are a big thing in the biohacker community for sleep optimization. It's a good example. I mean, our bodies, our genetics has not adapted to this much blue light all the time. So you need protective measures, like our water supply is contaminated with, you know, whatever is going on in there. You need water filters, and then you need some kind of electromagnetic field, you know, protection equipment to protect yourself from modern amenities. Now, what is that all about? It's about recognizing that we are not in tune with our environment, and you try to get yourself back in tune. And there is a limit to it, you know, you can do so much. So the next step would be to like physically change your biology. And this is what some biohackers are pushing things to with longevity technologies, you know, it's stem cell therapies, you know, it's gene therapies, it is rejuvenative medicine, maybe even 3D printing organs, whatever, like technological means, maybe some nanobots somewhere in your bloodstream, you know, tapping off all those cancerous cells, whatever. But I see that there is a reason why we die. And basically, the most effective mechanism for making sure that we live forever is natural selection. Like I see natural selection and genetic expression changing as a filter mechanism for filtering out information that in terms of our biology that actually works in its environment, in its context. So through epigenetics, we adapt, and things that don't work, those die. That's kind of the good thing, you know, about the way how nature kind of designed our organism to be extremely resilient to change. And You live forever when you pass on your genes. You pass on the information to the next generation. So when you reproduce and you die, you pass on the information of what things, for example, in terms of stress management, are useful. What thing, like in my heritage, like if you look at, you know, my ancestors, my blood sugar regulation is pretty good in a fasted state. Why is that? Because, you know, your ancestors went days on without food. You know, they were able to tap into energy that's already in their body. In my case, I'm more likely to get diabetes, like if I spike my blood sugar levels, because maybe my ancestors didn't have like an abundance of fruit, you know? That's the thing, is like, I'm aware of that fact, and I can use that for my health. But I think I would collectively make a wrong thing by trying to live forever, because in the end, I wouldn't allow the genetic selection to happen. You know, if I wouldn't reproduce, I would just exist as 21-year-old, modifying myself into whatever is needed to exist in that equilibrium. Like an organism, a human organism exists in a very narrow band of equilibrium where health, where life is possible. Like if you think of temperature, even like how many degrees can temperature increase until you become a bit nauseous, or how low can it go? Like it's a very narrow band. It's in many things. It's like that. And if we get global warming, you know, maybe you need to really like seriously like modify your organism just to be able to cope with what's going on. You can't just like do cold therapy like every day and assume the best. You just have to modify yourself at some point. So I think it's a good thing that we die eventually. So I have a slightly different view than many of these, I guess, life expectancy maximalists have. I believe in health span. Moving from lifespan to health span so that you have more healthy years in the time given. That's good. But would I live forever? I think collectively that's not a good idea, because I see that our world will be changing even at an accelerating phase, even faster than right now. And our ability to keep up with it will be hindered if we extend lifespan. So that's just the view I have.
No, that's really interesting. And again, another grounded approach, Timo. There's a UK astrologer called Brian Cox. I don't know if you know him. He's done a lot of work on the BBC, and I was watching one of his documentaries a little while ago, and he talks about right now, this is very abstract, by the way, so apologies. We're in a time called the stolliferous period, and it's the only time where the stars are all burning in the universe, and at some point the last star will burn out. And we will be in a forever darkness. And that just blew my mind, because I always had this thought of probably we could get something where we could live forever, or there'll always be some sort of life. And actually, who knows what happens with the universe is expanding and contracting. Maybe it keeps reset itself. Who knows? But what he was saying was at some point, the last candle will blow out. And at that point, there is no ability for life. And that really gave me a new frame of mind thinking, OK, so there is no such thing as life forever.
Yeah, the whole idea that the universe is going towards entropy, like things are just like expanding out from each other. It's the same process happening in our bodies. I mean, as you age, the DNA damage just increases exponentially. Like your body is going towards entropy. That is aging. You know, in so many levels, you're going towards entropy. You just like disseminate. And one of those, that's kind of one of the key ideas. Like if you just look at, you know, all the theories of the universe, I mean, that's the macrocosm. But when you go to the microcosm, it's the same, you know, on our bodies, like same process, same way how things happen. And when it comes to, you know, biohacking journey, it made me very aware of, you know, these kind of processes. It put me in touch with very deep questions. I'm interested in, you know, I'm just intrigued philosophically about the ideas of, let's say, transhumanism, what it means to transcend, what it means to be human. Those ideas have been put forward by thousands of years, like different philosophers and idealists. And there is, even in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, Maslow himself, if you know, you need shelter, you need food, you need family, whatever, and then you need ways of expressing yourself, like your work and so on. And on the top of that pyramid, you have like, yeah, self-expression, like creativity and stuff like that. So you have all the basics sustained. Now, he had an extra step that's not included in his original pyramid that he revised later on. But in the time when he designed that, he was a bit afraid to actually say what the last step is, because it was against many religious ideas. And the last step was transcending what it means to be human. So it was basically transhumanism, like in the core of what it means to be human, changing that part, basically playing God is the last step. And that's like playing with fire, right? With genetic editing and so on. Like, a lot of people have sounded the alarm, you know, in today's world about, are we going a little bit too far with, you know, playing God? Maybe, you know, genetic editing is a stupid idea. Maybe we shouldn't play with things we don't know about. But I see that it's a natural process. Like, we create our tools and then our tools create us. We are an extension of, you know, ourselves in a way. Our scientific thinking, our tools and technologies are an extension of us, like Marshall McLuhan used to say. And the tools are leverages for us to attempt and try things. And many scientific experiments, they completely fail, you know. But you need that experimentation to make breakthroughs. So in the end, although I'm a technological determinist, I believe that evolution is driven forward extremely quickly now by technology. I'm also an optimist in a way, that I believe that there is more good in the end of the rainbow, that there is like potential problems, because I see we're not going to survive otherwise. Like, when the last candle blows out, the only way for making sure that this civilization exists is the fact that we have been able to move to other planets. We have been able to move outside of this solar system or whatever. And that's one way how we might reproduce in the future. We create some kind of technology that we send to the next star and it reproduces there and continues living on. So the human race is extremely resilient organism and tough to kill. And we need to experiment to be able to see what works and what doesn't. Sometimes we might end up with an apocalyptic event. And if you look at civilizations before us, all of them have gone through iterations of this. Like, hundreds of civilizations have grown and collapsed, like the Egyptians, the Mayans, the Aztecs, and many of them collapsed to what? Like, I mean, they tried to create a well-functioning society. Technology, infrastructure, water supply, food production, whatever, and then some, you know, virus or famine or some environmental disaster or, you know, floods. Something came and they were wiped out. And then another civilization came in place of them to try again. Now, in modern age, we are on an extended time period compared to earlier civilizations. Because of technology, we are still here, you know? Because of antibiotics, for example, we have been able to extend lifespan, like literally. And now we see our tools are turning against us. You know, we have antibiotic-resistant bacteria, you know? That's the story, you know. Many of these things are pushing the envelope and turning against us later on. And I see it as a natural process. So I'm not a fundamentalist, you know, I'm a philosopher at core. So when I look at the virus that is going around the world right now, I see it as a good thing. You know, every 100 years, 10 to 40% of world population has died in whatever, you know, plague or what smallpox or whatever has been going around. Because natural selection needs to happen, because after all of those events, always the fittest remain to continue the torch forward. And it's okay, you know, I'm okay even if we are wiped out, because there's going to be another attempt. So, but I see in the end of it, like, we are running out of resources on this planet. There's just too much people. Technology is the only way to sustain ourselves here to an extended period of time. And we probably need to move out. How that's going to happen, I mean, there's going to be a lot of blunders on the way, for sure.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Fascinating level of conversation here. I want to switch up, if you don't mind, though, Timo, and talk a bit about breath work. I'll still think about death.
We'll bring ourselves back at the moment.
We'll pull ourselves back, but they're very interested. So what I would love to hear from you is, what was your breath work journey? What does your breath work practices look like now? And what is the science telling you about breath work?
Yeah, when I got the ulcer, the key things that really helped me were related to breath work. I mean, diet was awesome, but breath work was even more. And I basically signed up for an art of breathing course that was from the Art of Living Foundation, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. And so they have this course, they run it all around the world. I heard also in Silicon Valley, like, there is like a bunch of entrepreneurs who have met like each other, you know, to do this particular breath work. And basically I learned the basic pranayama breathing techniques. In Art of Living, they have this Sudarshan Kriya breathing practice, and it was like the best return on investment when it comes to breathing techniques for me. Like, it's basically a typical pranayama breathing technique, slowly inhaling, breath hold, slowly exhaling, a little bit longer than the inhale, and shorter breath hold on the bottom than on the top, and breathing in. And specific ways of filling the lungs and holding breath and expelling the breath. And then some Wim Hof type breathing techniques as well, in the longer form of Sudarshan Kriya. And that was very effective, because I noticed that the pain that I had went away every time I did those things. So then I started looking into how can I measure this, and I discovered the HeartMath devices, which is basically, they talk about heart coherence, which is related to the heart rate variability. So it's a biofeedback device where you put a sensor on your pulse, and then you do breathing techniques according to it's a typical box breathing technique that they guide you through. And it increases heart rate variability. And it's with this biofeedback, you become aware of your heart rate. And what I learned doing it over a long period of time was that I was able to increase heart rate variability at will. I was able to reduce my heart rate at will. And I started using that in my work also. If I have a presentation or I will go to a meeting, I would bring my heart rate down. I would increase heart rate variability just before that, just as an example. And it came to a point where I didn't need the devices anymore. I didn't need to track it. I was able to do it myself at will. And so that gave me, you know, real understanding of the power of controlling your own nervous system. The autonomic nervous system is autonomic, yes, but there is one part that you have influence over, and that's your breathing. And that's how I got into breathing techniques. Now, I started doing meditation combined with breathing techniques. I've done like typical mindfulness breathing, mindfulness meditation stuff also, but I find more effective for myself to focus on breathing also simultaneously. It's just more effective doing it that way. And since then, I actually this year I started like going really into meditation and breathing. Like I was doing that on a regular basis, but I decided to try doing it every single day. So every single day, when I woke up, I would do the following. So just to wake myself up, I would do a Wim Hof type of breathing okay. practice, where I would basically exercise breath holds in an extended way. I would do 4 rounds, increasing 1 minute at a time for the breath hold. And I also modified it a little bit. So it's usually like you basically breathe out all the CO2, like, etc. 30 times. And then in the end of that, you empty your lungs and you hold your breath. And then you fill your lungs, you hold your breath for 15 seconds, and then you exhale. What I would do is I would do like 4 rounds of that, and then I would reverse it. So I would basically, instead of emptying my lungs and holding it, I would fill my lungs and hold it for an extended period of time. And I find it kind of a Kundalini experience, almost like when you really like contract specific muscles in your body, especially in the pelvis area. It really like pushes blood into your brain in a way, and it really releases, I guess it's adrenaline that is pumped into your bloodstream when doing it. And it completely wakes me up. And I found out that when I do that, after that, when I go into a pranayama type of breathing for a while, I get into very interesting places and interesting states. It's much more easier for me to meditate after that, like straight into it. And then after doing some pranayama for a while, different techniques that I've learned, I would just do extended like 1 minute inhalation, 1 minute exhalation breathing, and just meditate in a more of a lotus kind of position. I would do the Wim Hof while lying on my back, and I get now what I guess yogis are describing as samadhi. The space between dying and being reborn, talking about death and near-death experiences, like that's the easy way for me to get myself into that. I'm nobody. I'm nothing. I don't exist kind of state. And I've noticed that my sessions, because I don't have like busy schedule now, I really took advantage of the fact that I'm not on an airplane all the time. And I just have this daily routine. I would start in the morning, and I would notice that I get out of the meditation when it's like lunchtime. So it'd take me like 2-3 hours sometimes. Wow. Sometimes, yeah, it's long. Like, and it used to be really hard to be in those states. But when I do it through breathing, I can just sustain myself much longer and be less anxious about meditating. And yeah. And when I come out of it, like the rest of the day is just amazing. Like, my focus, my attention, my motivation, my lack of anxiety, whatever, like it's just like there. And this is one thing that I hope that I had learned 10 years ago when I learned all these breathing techniques, that do it every day. Like, seriously, man, like it's very powerful when you really like do it on a repeated basis. And I've used tons of technologies like to meditate. I've used them. For example, and I've used NeuroSky and others. In the early days, I used NeuroSky, so it's similar to Muse, but I had an application that would give me a sine wave, basically, and the sine wave, the sound would be high when I'm not in a relaxed state, and it would be very low. It would be like, and it would be like when I'm in a more relaxed, like neurological state. And this sound alone was very useful for me to like bring myself into extremely relaxed states and calm meditation. So I think I learned through the hard math, like heart rate variability biofeedback, and by using EEG devices as feedback, as neurofeedback, I learned to get into states of mind where I'm not really thinking anything, and it's pretty good. And I've used more sophisticated devices later on, but I don't really use that much EEG stuff anymore. I've also experimented now when I was explaining my breathing techniques in the morning, I would often do it in such a way that instead of going like into this very deep, like 1 minute breathing things, I would actually end up under a red light panel with a spike mat and the Sensate. Sensate is this is a stone that kind of vibrates with ultrasound. So you put that on your collarbone.
Yeah.
And it has some biofeedback through headphones, like binaural beats. So I like to combine this with binaural beats, and I would sit under the red light for the biomodulation device and on a spike mat using the Sensate device. I've noticed that the red light and the infrared light, it increases blood flow, mm-hmm. and it increases your heart rate. So it kind of brings you out from a very deep, relaxed, meditative state. Mm-hmm. It's anti-inflammatory, yes, but it's I think it kind of, to me, it seems it's stimulating the sympathetic nervous system. So it's a pretty good thing to do in the morning, actually, like just to get, you know, you do the Wim Hof, you get some adrenaline going on, you take some red light, and you're ready to go for the day. So to me, red light works best in the morning. In the evening, it's maybe a bit too stimulating in that sense.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So that's the way how I use these things. And
yeah,
the Sensate is at the Biohacker Center office, we have a device called Neurosonic. It's a low-level vibrating mattress. So you have a physical sensation of vibration going throughout your body, and it really relaxes you. And with many like issues with anxiety and stress, you just have to get yourself into body. And I think that's why one of the key things what breathing techniques do and cold therapy does and sauna is, it really brings you into your body and exercise. But if you are overstimulated, like the Sensate is a cheap way of like bringing yourself back to your body. The Neurosonic is a bit too expensive device to have at home for many, but like the Sensate is cheap for it. So it's portable. So I like that. And yeah, what else? I've used a bunch of wearables also, and to track breathing. So I don't have it here, but I have the Inner Balance. It's a mobile version of the HeartMath device. So I've used that. And right now I also have the Bio strap on my hand. So mm-hmm. I can show you on.
Oh, yes, please.
On my screen. Just a second. I'll just. Hello, yep. Here we go. So it gives you your active heart rate, but it also gives your active heart rate variability. And I mean, this is now all over the place, but because I've been moving around, but this device potentially gives you real-time view of your HRV. Not because I'm moving, it's not showing it, but it really like shows up here if I'm still. So what I can do is I can just use this device. It also works with because kind of a standard heart rate monitor. But instead, yes, of around the chest, which is kind of hard to put on, you just put it on your what is this part of the hand here?
Yeah.
So there's a strap around here. So that's okay. This is their kind of sport equipment, but so that you can measure your workouts more accurately. And I use that for breathing stuff. So I can use different applications that take the HRV and use some kind of standard. Now I see the heart rate variability also. Let's see if I can show that to you without moving too much. That disappeared in the second when I tried to show you that.
But it, I can see on there also it shows your respiratory rate and your blood oxygen saturation levels as well.
Yeah, that's a nice thing about it. Is like I use the Oura Ring for my for my night sleep, but Oura Ring doesn't give you your oxygen saturation, and you want your oxygen saturation to be at night, for example, between 95 and 100. And so this one uses a green. It uses a red infrared lead that penetrates deeper into the tissue, so it can read stuff like this, what typical activity trackers or the Oura Ring can't do, because the Oura Ring and Fitbits, etc., they use the green lead. The green lead is good for it's often used in the fitness tracker industry because it is cheap, and it's also less prone to movement disturbances. So if you want to measure accurately your heart activity in meditation or during breathing, the red LEDs are actually more accurate. They go deeper than a green one. Yeah. If you exercise, then you want to use a green LED usually, because that's the activity trackers are very sensitive to movement. Like if you have it in your wrist, it tends to move a little bit around and it influences its ability to read your heart rate. So that's why they use the green LED. It's a little bit less prone to movement issues. But anyway, so and it consumes also less energy than the red one.
Yeah,
the red one goes more into heat, I guess. But yeah, so that's. That's what I have to say about some of these devices.
Yeah, now, very interesting.
There are some devices out there also. I think one of them is called Spire that you put on your belt and it measures your breathing, and it can alert you if you're breathing shallow and too fast. And I think one of the things that really people need to consider is really to do more nasal breathing throughout the day and consciously slowing down their respiratory rate per minute. Because that is related to longevity. People who practice sports and they practice like high heart rates and heart rate zones, they tend to have lower resting heart rate, lower breathing rate also. At rest, if they're not overly stimulated or overtrained state, so that's one thing. And I sometimes use also for breathing this little device here. That is basically something you stick in your nose like that, and it opens up your nostrils.
Yeah,
and it actually increases your oxygen intake by 20 to 30%. Well, it's super easy. It makes breathing almost like impossibly effortless. So I sometimes use this when I work, for example. That's why I have here at my computer desk. This is a device I would use if you have nasal breathing problems, like that you feel a bit stuck or something like this, or the other nostril is often like tighter than the other one. This makes breathing so much easier. And if you're doing like some fire breathing things or something like that, it's much easier with this device. And this is a 3D printed thing. I got this from Lee Evin from Finland, who is his brand is Nasal. He's into breathing techniques and teaching those to people. And this was one of the biggest things he raved about, and I had to try it. It's super simple, like cost maybe 10 cents, but the effectiveness for breathing is amazing.
Oh, I love that. I love simple things that make a difference. Have you ever played with anything like this? This is the O2 trainer from Baz Rutan, but essentially what it does is it puts resistance on the exhale, so you can breathe, and it toughens up the diaphragm. It gets the diaphragm muscle working a bit harder, a bit like blowing a balloon. Have you played with that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I have the power lung. I have a similar device that constricts your breathing. So these altitude training masks and whatever is constraining your breathing, those are amazing. I think there is also, I don't remember the name of that device now, but there is a mobile kind of Bluetooth connected version of that, okay, which basically measures things, and you get those sessions in your phone. So when you do like constricted breathing, it really improves your lung capacity and oxygen intake ability and so on. So I know that some athletes, a Finnish ice hockey team, for example, they often travel to high altitude to train, because if you practice in high altitude and you come to ocean level, everything feels like super easy suddenly. Yeah. I like those kind of things, but in the end, you're not really fully emulating a high altitude. You're just constricting breathing. But one thing I learned from a cardiologist, a Finnish professor who has studied like the cardiovascular system all her life, and one of her passions is also playing blow instruments. Is that the term you use?
We would say maybe wind instrument. Yeah.
Wind instruments. Yeah. So wind instruments. And she noticed that some of those people who practice wind instruments, statistically, they have higher risk of getting like a cardiac arrest. And she studied that with interest. And there is something about like consciously breathing out and your breathing being constricted that can actually lead to in the heart into some issues that then can end up with some kind of arrhythmias or cardiac arrest or whatever. I don't remember all the exact details how she described that, but she definitely knew her stuff because she had written like several papers about it. That it's a very rare condition, but she also mentioned that similar thing can happen to people when they run, if they breathe in a wrong way. So why some people who do a marathon might like collapse and get a heart attack, completely healthy people, is that when they hit the ground with their feet, it really matters if you how you're breathing at the same time. If your breathing is coming alternating with your movement, or if it's coming at the same time when you hit the ground, like there's some kind of pressure thing right there that could potentially lead to problems. So that just highlighted to me how important breathing is. And, you know, many martial arts and so on, you basically move with breathing. In yoga, you move with breathing. You always use breathing with the movement. And I think it's very important to learn whatever you're doing, like lifting heavy weights at the gym, doing yoga, running, that you learn the proper breathing technique. It might save your life even.
Wow. Yes, because you hear about that a lot, don't you, about people having heart attacks at the end of a marathon. And I thought you were going to say they were mouth breathing and that was putting too much stress on the system. But I didn't expect you to say that about the way that they land. Wow. What's the cardiologist's name, out of interest, that you just mentioned there?
Oh, I don't remember her name. I have to look it up.
Okay.
It's years ago when because we spoke about these things in a webinar, and she contacted us and sent me like papers and talked about the details, called me. We had a good call for an hour and she explained all the details, like why people who play wind instruments have sometimes cardiac problems. Wow. And that there is connection to the fact that you have to push air against pressure, and that's how, like, and it's somehow related also the way marathoners might die sometimes. So I can't give you all the details, but that's just a hint for maybe some listener to dig deeper and figure out like what that's all about. But it really highlights why learning to breathe properly is important. And I also know that the Wim Hof method and all that, it can be dangerous for some people. Like there is a small number of people who will, for example, could pass out of doing techniques like that and not being aware of it at all. And it's a rare thing, but it can happen if you don't have the right technique.
Yeah. Wow. So I've got one last question for you, but before we I close on that question, where can people find you and where do you want to route them to?
Yeah, so if you're interested in, you know, optimizing your health and performance, biohacking and all that, you should definitely check out the Biohacker's Handbook. You can find more information at biohackingbook.com. If you're interested in the events that we organize, we have online and face-to-face events as well. That's biohackersummit.com. And you can follow us on Instagram. Also, we put a lot of information out there, like free information, very informative stuff at the Biohacking Book Instagram account and also Biohacker Summit. So that's where you can find your community. And talking about community, we are now setting up a new community site. It's at biohacker.community. So www.biohacker.community. It's kind of like a similar platform to Facebook, but it's only for biohackers, and there's a social network, and there's some interesting people. So it's a lot of these kind of early adopters of these technologies sharing what they know. I figured out that there is no forum really. Like, I mean, it's a lot of like brands just pushing things one way on Instagram and whatever, and maybe a few Facebook groups. So we just decided to set it up and see where that goes. And yeah, I mean, yeah. Also, we have a YouTube channel. The Biohacker Summit YouTube channel is the one that we update. And I will start producing a series of biohacks there on a monthly basis. So if you follow the channel, there's a lot of like presentation recordings from previous Biohacker Summits and interviews with some of the experts in the industry. And I will be publishing also not just our live streams and webinars, but other things also on that YouTube channel. So check it out.
Fantastic. I look forward to seeing that content. Thank you, Timo. I will link, guys, to all of that below in the description, so you can just literally scroll down now and you've got all those links there. So you can go and subscribe to the YouTube channel and check out all the other links as well. Okay, last question for you. So somebody, I'm all about action and taking immediate action. So there's people watching this now. They're listening to this right now. This podcast is about to finish in a minute or two. What should the next bit of action be that you recommend for somebody that wants to improve their health? Is it the website? Is it going to do some breathing? Is it going for a run? Is it going to get some sunlight? What would be the next immediate action somebody can do straight after this podcast?
Yeah, I mean, many people ask me like, okay, what gadget should I get? You know, them gave me all these ideas about what I can use for breathing. You know, in the end, ask yourself the question like, what's the problem that you're trying to fix? Like, what is the real thing you really want to focus on? Because that's your motivation. That's where your motivation really is. Like, if you have stress, probably get more bang for the buck from some stress management tools and techniques than you would get from a, let's say, sport activity tracker, etc. So if you are very much into, you know, exercise and all that, you may want to get the more a variable that's more directed to recovering from workouts or doing the workouts themselves, etc. If you're enthusiastic about food and nutrition, like geek into that stuff. So to me, that's the first step, is to be aware of what is the problem you really try to solve and figure out what is the best tool for that, because there is many tools of trade for sure. The Oura Ring is not very good for workouts, for example. It's actually pretty poor for that. It's good for sleep. If you have sleep problems, get an Oura. If you have stress management issues, maybe a Sensei could be a pretty nice start if you're not really a person who tracks on things. If you want to geek on, you know, optimizing your nutritional status, get lab work instead of, you know, any of these gadgets. So I think it's a good starting point to realize what problem you're really dealing with.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time, Timo. Guys, once again, thank you for watching. Please like, subscribe and share if you haven't done so already. And if you think there's somebody out there that needs to hear the messages we've talked about today, maybe share this with one of those people as well. Timo, once again, thank you for your time. And hopefully we'll have you back at some point for a part two. Take care.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mike. Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks for watching. Take a deep breath. Thanks for watching our breathcast. I hope you enjoyed the guest that we just had. Just a couple of quick messages. Thank you for sticking through to the end. Really appreciate it. If you enjoyed that and you haven't subscribed, please click that subscribe button and leave us a question or a comment, because it helps the Google algorithm. And it also means that we can interact and other people get involved and answer questions. So leave us a little question. That would be incredible. On Instagram, you can follow me at takeadeepbreath.co.uk, and we've got regular content there. And finally, in the link below, we have a breath store. So what is that? So we have taken some of our top videos. I say we, it's me. I've taken some of our top videos and converted them into an MP3 format. And for just a couple of dollars, $4 or $5, you can go to this little store. You can go through PayPal or through your debit or credit cards, all secure, legit. And you can buy one of our MP3s. And that way you're supporting the channel. But not only that, you get to keep the MP3 forever. There's no ads, there's no anything else going on. So you can listen to it on your phone, on the aeroplane when there's no signal. And that's yours to keep forever. So yeah, that's down below. And that's our breath store, which has got, I think, 8 or 9 different breathing exercises on there. We're adding more as we go. And that's it. So yeah, so thank you so much from me. And we hope to see you on the next exercise or the next breath cast. And if you're finishing this right now and you're thinking, got a few minutes spare, not sure what to do, then try one of the breathing exercises. Box breathing is a lovely way just to help slow things down and relax us. You could do some alternate nostril breathing. Just go and have a look at the channel, look at the playlists and pick something for you. Give yourself a little treat. And we will see you on the next video. Thank you very much. Cheers.